Thank you. Be seated. Good afternoon and welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. We have a case to be argued at 2:30. And before we begin, let me introduce the panel to you. To my right is Justice Dana Womack. To my left is Justice Brian Walker. And I'm Bonnie Sutterth. I'm the Chief Justice of the Court. We appreciate your being here today. I understand that the attorneys are ready to argue. And before you do, I'll ask the clerk to call the case.
The court now calls number 02-25-263-CB in the estate of Lonnie K. Ledbetter, Jr. May it please the court, Mr. Nicholas Bruno will argue for appellant and Mr. Joe Greenhill will argue for appellant.
Thank you. Mr. Bruno?
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the court. The jurisdictional issue that arises today is because the appellees chose a forum other than the default district court forum that is the exclusive jurisdiction over trust claims. As a result, what Supreme Court has called the most complex web of jurisdiction, that probate jurisdiction is implicated. But in Hood County, the answer is the question, and the answer is really quite simple. Are these trust claims probate matters? And the answer is clearly not. I want to start with a jurisdictional issue, and I'll try at the end of my remarks make a brief point about the merits of the temporary injunction, but obviously the jurisdictional issue is the threshold. The Hood County Court at Law does not have jurisdiction over the trust claims. And the appellees want to start with the government code, but the Supreme Court is, and we'll talk about that in a minute, but the Supreme Court is clear that we start with the county-specific statute's jurisdictional grant, not the general rule. The Hood County statute, the only subpart, subpart C2, that the appellees use for jurisdiction, only extends jurisdiction over probate matters. It is pretty clear that the trust claims are not probate matters, and it's the analysis under the Hood County statute is really that simple. So the appellees turn to the general rules under the government code to try to evade the Hood County statute. There's two basic problems with that effort. One issue is the assignment of any statutory probate judge was error, even under 25-0022, which we heard about for the first time on appeal. The other issue is it really doesn't get the appellees anywhere. I'll start with the second because I think it's pretty straightforward. The best day for the appellees is that they get a statutory probate judge under 25-0022, and that triggers Section 32006 jurisdiction under the estates code. That's their argument. The problem with that argument is the introductory clause to Section 32006, which states that that jurisdictional grant only applies in a county with a statutory probate court. Hood County does not have a statutory probate court. We've raised this introductory clause below in our appellate briefing. We've never received an answer from the appellees as to what this introductory clause could mean, other than our interpretation, which is it doesn't apply when a statutory probate judge is hearing a case in a non-statutory probate court in a county without such a court. Indeed, there is no other possible explanation. That introductory clause is not needed in counties with statutory probate courts. And when the regular judge, for lack of a better word, is presiding over their own case in a non-statutory probate court, that statute is never implicated at all. So again, we don't need the introductory clause. The only circumstance where the introductory clause to 32006 matters is when a statutory probate judge is appointed to hear a matter in another court in a county without a statutory probate court. That's what we have here. And that introductory clause prevents 32006 jurisdiction from flowing to the Hood County court statute. So that's the appellee's best day, is that they get that jurisdiction. But I don't think they even get a statutory probate judge at all under 25-002H. You know, 25-002H essentially lays out various circumstances in which judges can various judges can request the appointment of a statutory probate judge. But we found no authority, and the appellees have cited you no authority, that 25002 is an independent grant of authority to request such a judge. When you look at the text of 25002, it's inconsistent with that position because it does not say when a judge has the ability to request a statutory probate judge. The natural way to read 25002 is, yes, a statutory probate judge can be appointed upon a request of certain judges, like an administrative regional judge, but only in a circumstance in which that other judge has authority elsewhere to make such a request. So let me give you an example from one of the counties that appeals here to the Second Court of Appeals, the Denton County statute. In Denton County, the second county court at law has probate jurisdiction. Denton County also has a statutory probate court. The Denton County Court at Law statute says that the regional administrative judge can request the assignment of a statutory probate judge in the Denton County Court at Law number 2. In that circumstance, you see the Denton County Court at Law specific statute working hand in glove with 25002 to allow the appointment of a statutory probate judge in Denton County. But in Hood County, that just doesn't exist. You have 25002, which provides the mechanism for the appointment, but no authority for when the regional presiding judge can request. So we don't think you even get a statutory probate judge under 25002 in Hood County, which obviously eliminates the rest of the appellee's arguments. As regards to jurisdiction, I want to also address a couple points I anticipate the appellees making from their bench exhibits that were filed late yesterday. The appellees reference section 32007 of the Estates Code as a basis for jurisdiction. 32007 is not an independent grant of jurisdiction, separate and apart from 32006. And again, we see a changing of the appellee's argument. We heard about 32007 was not the basis of their argument at the trial court, wasn't the basis of their argument in their appellate court briefing. Heard about it for the first time in their bench exhibits, I think for good reason. 32007 merely recognizes the circumstances in which jurisdiction granted elsewhere in the Estates Code is concurrent with a district court. 32005 recognizes the circumstances which a probate court's jurisdiction is exclusive of the district court. Why do I say that? We can know that 32007 is not an independent grant. Number one, there's no authority that holds this an independent grant. In fact, the appellate court decisions, such as the Lee decision that we cite in our briefing, the Johnson decision that both sides have cited in their briefing, routinely cite section 32006 as the grant of trust jurisdiction, and then 007 as concurrent, the fact that that jurisdiction is concurrent. Second, we know that 32007 is not an independent grant of jurisdiction because it would render 32006 and 31.002 superfluous and meaningless. Every alleged grant of jurisdiction in 32007 is listed in either 32006 or 31.002A, meaning if section 32007 is an independent grant, those grants and those other statutes did not need to exist. Again, when you look at the structure of the Estates Code as a whole, when you look at the text holistically, the textual conclusion's straightforward. 3207 is not an independent grant of jurisdiction. The other thing that I will just point out from the bench exhibits that I found very interesting was the reference to Cook County. You'll recall from the briefing, we briefed how the Ector County statute, creating the Ector County Court at Law, been interpreted as providing original probate jurisdiction to the Ector County Court at Law. Argued how that was similar to the Hood County statute. What's interesting is this: the appellees cite the Cook County statute, which subsection A of the Cook County statute is identical to subsection A of the Hood County Court at Law statute. In this court's opinion, in the estate of Strong case that the appellees cite in their briefing, was clear in footnote 3 that same language created original probate jurisdiction in Cook County. I think that's about as conclusive as it can get under this court's precedent, under Mischke, the Hood County Court at Law has original probate jurisdiction. Now, there's a nuance. Subsection E says that certain there's not probate jurisdiction unless granted by subsection C. So there's nuance as to the scope of that original probate jurisdiction. But I think under this court's precedent in Strong, it's pretty clear there is original probate jurisdiction in Hood County.
Let me stop you real quick.
Of course, Your Honor.
Because you started off with your argument saying that this is clear, and, you know, that's not a word I typically use in just about any statutory interpretation case. Everything you've said at this point, any argument that it's clear is probably, you know, they're going to disagree with that, obviously, and clarity is quite subjective in these instances. I'm going to read you something from their argument, and then I just want you to respond to it as succinctly as you can. But they say, when Section 32003E is read alongside the authority of assigned judges under Texas Government Code Section 25002I, this portion of a state's code Section 32003E is clear and consistent. This language in the estate's code and government code illustrate the explicit legislature's wish to provide the benefits that larger counties enjoy to their smaller, more rural brethren that may need the expertise and expanded jurisdiction of a statutory probate court judge. What is your quick response to that statement by itself?
Yeah, there's 2 points. Number one, 32003 doesn't apply in Hood County. 32003 only applies in a county that lacks a county court of law with original probate jurisdiction. That's not Hood County. So I think that defeats that entire argument, number one. Number two, we have no quarrel with the proposition that a statutory probate judge can be appointed in rural counties where the legislature has deemed it appropriate. But the legislature also has deemed that that appointment is not appropriate in counties where you have a county court at law exercising original probate jurisdiction, because the legislature has made the provision for that more specialized judge by creating a county court at law with such jurisdiction. So I understand the jurisdiction in the probate context is a bit of line drawing. And to take your Honor's point about clearness, there's a lot that's unclear about probate jurisdiction. I'm not going to fight your instinct there. The point that I'm making is clear is that the Hood County Court at Law has original probate jurisdiction. I think the reason I use the word clear is it's a straightforward application of this court's precedent in the Strong decision.
Do you think anything changed because Judge Haddock's recused in this case, though, and requested Judge Evans to make an appointment, and then he, under the government code, could seek a statutory probate court appointment?
The regional administrative judge can seek the appointment of a judge. I've not seen a situation where you can import a different type of judge to a local court. So to answer your question succinctly, no, I don't think the recusal made a material impact on the ability to get a statutory probate judge. And I'll note, again, even if the court thinks that a statutory probate judge can be appointed in Hood County, it still must deal with the introductory clause to 32006, because all that means is you get a judge. That doesn't necessarily mean that the judge has the 32006 jurisdiction, which is the trust jurisdiction. And I'll make one point with relation to that as well. It's related. The appellees are likely to emphasize subsection E of the Hood County statute. It says there's no probate jurisdiction except as provided by C. But I think that actually cuts against their argument. Recall, the Supreme Court said the specific controls over the general. So whatever the case may be with regards to 3206, 3207, other waterfall provisions of the estates code, the legislature's clear that in Hood County, the only pertinent jurisdiction is the jurisdiction in C2 over probate matters. So even if you don't want to take the step to say no probate judge can be appointed in Hood County, I think the E section cuts against the appellees. We talked about pendant and ancillary jurisdiction in the briefing, so I'm not going to belabor that point here, other than to note that in our briefing we had a placeholder for a pin site for the point that there's not assets in the estate. The third supplemental clerk's record has come in since then. It's pages 86 and 87. The reason that that pin site is important is under this court's precedent for ancillary impendent jurisdiction to exist, the resolution of the other claims, in this case the trust claims, must be necessary to the administration of the estate. There's no estate assets to administer that the trust claims can help with. No matter how the trust claims are resolved, that merely impacts who receives the benefits of those trusts. It does not impact the administration of the estate. So under the necessary prong, there is no pendant and ancillary jurisdiction. That's assuming these are pendant and ancillary claims at all, which the appellees have not yet engaged the case law that says that they are not. In my last few seconds, I'll touch briefly on the TI. Most of this is the court is well able to apply, I think, on the briefing. I just invite the court to look at the irreparable harm and overbreadth arguments hand in hand. In this court's decision in the Spain v. Manpower decision, the court was clear that you could only look to the irreparable harm specifically identified in the temporary injunction. Here, that is Tawny's alleged insolvency. There's absolutely no evidence of that in unique assets. And this injunction goes far beyond enjoining any unique assets like real estate. I think once when the court combines those two analyses, they'll make some of the writing of the opinion, I hope, on that part a little easier.
So you're saying that we can't uphold on any ground that finds support in the record?
There is case law, and I'm sorry, Your Honor, my time's up. May I respond to your question?
Yes.
The case law that says that any ground in the record arises from findings of facts that support a viable cause of action.
So you think it's limited just to findings of fact and conclusions of law?
Yes, and I think if you look at the Spain v. Manpower decision, it makes that distinction between the viable cause of action and findings of fact with regards to that aspect and the Rule 683 requirement that the reasons for issuance, the irreparable harm, be specifically identified in the temporary injunction. And again, that's straight from your court's decision in the Spain v. Manpower decision.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Greenhill.
Madam Chief Justice, may it please the court. So as you know, there are two issues, primary issues in this case. One is, did Judge Chu have jurisdiction to enter the injunction? And if so, can that injunction withstand a merits-based review? And because we believe the answer to both questions is yes, we ask the court to affirm. So with the time I have today, I'm going to focus on two primary things. First, I'm going to get into jurisdiction because obviously that's a dispositive issue the court has to decide. And then second, I'm going to get into the evidence supporting our likelihood to prevail on the merits of our claims. And the reason I'm going to do it that way is because the form complaints that the appellant has raised are remand points. In the data scan case, the court said, look, if we find technical defects, and we don't believe there are any, and I'm going to touch on if I have an opportunity to. If we find defects, we identify them, we don't dissolve the injunction, we send it back down to the trial court. So getting into jurisdiction, I think it's not clear, it's a bit of a puzzle, but I do think it is, once you get there, semi-simple, and I'll say it that way. So their contention is Judge Chu, the duly assigned statutory probate judge, only has jurisdiction over the probate matters and that the trust issues that are involved with the injunction are non-probate matters over which the Judge Chu does not have jurisdiction. And I'll tell you, and they identified it correctly, Section 320037 is where we believe Judge Chu obtains his jurisdiction over trusts. Judge Chu actually cited this statute at the hearing. We cited it at the hearing as well, at the plea to the jurisdiction hearing. And that's in the third volume of the reporter's record at page 18. And then beyond that, even if Judge Chu does not have express jurisdiction over the trust issues, he has pendant ancillary jurisdiction over that, and I'm going to get into that after I discuss express jurisdiction. So with regard to the express jurisdiction, again, it's a bit of a puzzle piece, and so last night we filed a handout that provides the statutes that I think the court needs to look at when it's analyzing the jurisdictional issue.
Let me cut you off before you go there.
Sure.
What's your quick response to the preambulary language that says that it only applies to counties with a certain population?
Right? Your Honor is referring to 32006.
Right.
So my first response is we've also cited you to 32007, which also provides jurisdiction over trust issues and does not have the introductory language. But beyond that, and the court does not need to get there, if 32006 also provides jurisdiction over trust cases in which there's a county where there's a statutory probate judge, and I submit to you that when a statutory probate judge is duly assigned, he becomes the statutory probate judge for that case in that county and also draws jurisdiction from 006. But again, you can...
You don't even need 006.
You don't even need to get there. You can go into 007. And here's how I get to 007. So if you look at... you begin with 32003A. And that's where we made the request under that provision to have a statutory probate judge assigned to this case. And it says, in a county in which there's no statutory probate court or county court at law exercising original probate jurisdiction, and that's the phrase right there, county court at law exercising original probate jurisdiction that we disagree over, and I'm going to get into a minute why we don't think they're right on that. But assuming both of those are satisfied, then the on a party's motion, the county court where the case is filed can request a statutory probate judge to preside over the case. We made the request. Ultimately, Judge Evans requested that Judge Herman appoint Judge Chu. He did, and he came and exercised his jurisdiction over this case. So under 32000A, that's where the request was made. And then you slide down to 32003E. And that provision of 32 says, a statutory probate court judge assigned to a contested matter in a probate proceeding or to the entire proceeding under this section, and here's the important part, has the jurisdiction and authority granted to a statutory probate court by this subtitle. And what's included within the subtitle? Section 32007, which gives a statutory probate judge concurrent jurisdiction over trust matters. So that's how we got there. And then section 250022I, which we cited in our brief of the government code, also provides the judge assigned under, properly assigned, the jurisdiction given by section 32006, 007, and a number of different provisions that may or may not apply to this case. So that's how we've gotten from 3200A, 3A to 32007. Now, the big contention, I think, where the rubber is going to meet the road in this case is, does the Hood County Court of Law exercise original probate jurisdiction? Because that's why they've said 32003 doesn't apply. And I'll submit to you that it does not, and I'm going to tell you why. What they've said provides the original probate jurisdiction in the Hood County Court of Law is Texas Government Code Section 25113C2. Okay, and what that section says is the Hood County Court of Law has concurrent jurisdiction with the district court in contested probate matters under 32003A Estates Code. Okay, so it has concurrent jurisdiction over contested probate matters. Doesn't say original probate jurisdiction, which are different, obviously different terms, and as the court knows, the legislature chooses words carefully and uses different words for different things. And so beyond 25113C2, if you scroll down to part E of that statute, it says, except as provided by subsection C3 or C4, and this is a little confusing because it appears the legislature may have misnumbered when they amended the statute. Although it doesn't explicitly reference C2, I believe it's meaning to, and I don't know what the court does with that, but it's saying except as provided by C3 or C4, which I believe is referring to the contested probate matters under section 3207, the Hood County Court of Law, quote, does not have probate jurisdiction, right? So except for contested probate matters, which again I submit is different than original probate jurisdiction, the Hood County Court of Law does not have original probate jurisdiction. And so what the question I would ask then, okay, so then what would give a county court at law ever original probate jurisdiction? And what I point you to there is at the is the government code section 25003, okay, and that it's a general jurisdictional statute for county courts at law. And so this court in the Smith case and the Sari case, the Eastland case, sorry, that the appellant recited in their brief, they interpreted section 25003D as what gives a county court at law original probate jurisdiction. And that provision says a county court at law, quote, has concurrent with the county court the probate jurisdiction provided by general law for county courts. And again, the Sari case decided in appellant's reply brief, and the Smith case from this court said that part 003D is what gives county courts at law original probate jurisdiction. And then, again, I'm sorry, I keep transitioning. You go back to 25113C2, and while it says under subsection 25003, the jurisdiction, et cetera, then you skip down to part E of that, and it explicitly removes the original probate jurisdiction that the Hood County Court of Law might otherwise exercise. And that's about as simple as I can make it. I know it's a convoluted process, but I'll break it one more time. For us, you go from 32003A to 32003E, and then to 32007, and then to conclude that the Hood County Court of Law does not have original probate jurisdiction, you go from C2 to E, and then to D, and then back to E of 1132. So that's my web of jurisdictional maps there, and I apologize if I lost anybody on it, but hopefully the handout was that.
It's very clear.
Thank you. I told you it's simple once you get there, but it's a bit of a puzzle to put together. And so hopefully the handout can help you with that. And I'm going to briefly respond to a couple of the arguments they've made. They've told you that you know, the specific controls over the general. So 1132, whatever is in 1132 is the only kind of jurisdiction that a duly assigned statutory probate judge can ever exercise in Hood County. But I will tell you that canon of construction only applies when statutes are irreconcilable. And there's nothing or conflicting or irreconcilable. And there's no conflict between limiting the Hood County Court of Law to contested probate jurisdiction and also granting a duly appointed statutory probate judge the expanded jurisdiction they otherwise have. Otherwise, what's the point of the whole process of allowing these experts in probate law to be appointed for counties that don't otherwise have courts that have specialization in these matters? So I think the specific over the general is a little bit of a red herring when you consider it at the depth level. It has to be a conflict, and there's no conflict between 1132 and 007, which provides additional jurisdictions over trusts. So that is the express jurisdiction piece, and I'm sorry it took a little bit of time to get through. And just real quickly, I'm going to touch on the pendant and ancillary jurisdiction portion of it. This is section 32.001B, which says that a court exercising probate jurisdiction can also exercise pendant and ancillary jurisdiction as necessary to promote judicial efficiency and economy. So that what that means is if a probate court is exercising jurisdiction, there's issues that are not probate matters, they're non-probate matters, the probate court can exercise its jurisdiction over those if it's necessary to do so. And is this court laid out the test in the Stavron case written by Justice Womack, and is actually the same panel that's before us today. And what the court said in that case is that pendant and ancillary, it comes into play when there's a close relationship between the probate and non-probate claims. And then the fundamental question is whether the exercise of that jurisdiction will aid in the efficient administration of the estate. And I'll submit to you, Your Honors, that we certainly have that in this case.
And by the way, we get all the fun cases.
Oh, I can tell. You guys have a ball together. One thing I'll point to is we've challenged the 2024 will, the will that was executed in 2024. And if you look at that will, it purports to, the decedent purported to exercise the powers of appointment over the Ledbetter Trust and gave 80% of those trust assets to the appellant. And so the resolution of that probate issue will necessarily touch upon the trust issues in this case because they're intertwined. It's all part of his similar estate plan. And as Judge Chu actually noted at the plea of the jurisdiction hearing at 3RR24, he says, look, the estate matters, the trust matters, they're the same, they're based on our same allegations of undue influence, lack of capacity, breach of fiduciary duty, fraud, all the things that we've alleged in our petition and have put on evidence of at the temporary injunction hearing. He's going to have to hear, I have a quote, he says, someone's going to have to hear those facts in order to determine whether the estate documents are void. And he says, so whether it's a district court that hears it or he hears it, it's all going to be the same. So having the trust matters split off into a district court while Judge Chu then presides over the estate matters is the height of inefficiency. And it may end up resulting in inconsistent judgments that could, you know, the estate remains intact while the trusts are set aside or something like that. So it is necessary to the administration of the estate that one court, Judge Chu, who has jurisdiction over these claims, whether express or pendant and ancillary, hears the entire dispute. And oh, I'm sorry, one other point I want to make about pendant and ancillary. Their main point in their briefing, from what I could tell, was that pendant and ancillary really only means defensive claims. But in Stavron, the claims at issue that the probate court, the trial court, had exercised pendant and ancillary jurisdiction over, and this court affirmed, were claims for affirmative relief. It was an attorney's fees claim. So the idea that they can only apply to defensive claims is not right. And if you look at the definition of ancillary in Black's Law Dictionary, which you can look at to define statutory terms, it just defines a claim that has a similar relationship. It doesn't say defensive or anything of that matter. So that's the jurisdictional piece. So we think Judge Chu has expressed jurisdiction. And beyond that, we also think Judge Chu has got a jurisdiction under pendant and ancillary jurisdiction to hear the trust matters that have wrapped up in the injunction. And so with the time I have left, I'm just going to briefly touch on the merits of the injunction. And as I said earlier, I'm going to focus in on our the evidence supporting our likelihood to prevail on our undue influence and lack of capacity claims. And again, the reason I'm going to do that is because, as this court said in the DataScan Holdings case, which is cited in our brief, it's 2023 Westlaw 785-1509. When there's a technical defect in an injunction, the proper remedy is not to dissolve it; it's to identify it and then to remand it to the trial court for correction. And again, I'd love to address it if I've got the time. We don't think there's any technical defects in the injunction, and I think we've laid it out pretty extensively in our brief. But I'll get to it if I can. First, I'm going to focus on the rendition point because that's what the court has to decide first. So when you get to undue influence, again, likelihood to prevail on the merits at an injunction hearing, this is not a very high bar. You have to raise a bona fide issue as to the ultimate relief, right? It's some evidence is the touchstone. And so the way that we've gotten there with undue influence is we think there's a presumption of undue influence between the appellant and the decedent. And the reason we think that is because while they were married, they are each other's fiduciaries. And so any transaction from him to her or vice versa, the recipient has got the burden to prove the fairness of the transaction. And this court wrote about that in the Klutz case, and cited to the Danford case from the Houston Court of Appeals that talks about the presumption. And why we think the presumption is important is this, because if there's a presumption of undue influence, it raises a fact issue. Now, it's a fact issue that defeats a no evidence summary judgment. And I will acknowledge to you, I have not found any cases that then extended that to the TI context. I will submit to you that because the burdens in these situations is similar, some evidence, that it can be extended to that. But even if the court does not want to extend the holding from Klutz and Danford to that to this context, the presumption still raises a fact issue that makes, in those cases, summary judgment inappropriate. It doesn't shift. The burden is still on the appellant to prove the fairness of the transaction. At this stage, it's inappropriate then to say that she's done so, even though, of course, we don't think she has. In their reply brief, the appellants talked about how the presumption should not apply between spouses.
The some evidence standard, you know, I would assume that's more than a scintilla. Is there much indication about the quantum that it's talking about?
You know, Your Honor, now that I've been practicing for almost 15 years, I still don't have a firm grasp on one of some. It's just something that's there that, especially in an abuse of discretion standard, that led the trial court to believe that it is not more likely than not, because that's, you know, obviously is a preponderance of the evidence, and we're not quite there yet. Just to give you some sort of inkling, a bona fide issue that something is true, right? And so that's where I think the sum evidence standard comes in, and it can, and it operates in this case to support our ability to say we're going to succeed, or Judge Chu's conclusion that we are likely to succeed on both our undue influence or on an under undue influence claim. I'm sorry, capacity is different.
Is it your position that it can be the same thing that's required for summary judgment, to pass summary judgment, to defeat summary judgment?
Yes, Your Honor, in the Klutz case authored by Chief Justice Sutterth and the Danford case of the Houston Court of Appeals, the presumption where it arose there, it was a no evidence summary judgment case, and the presumption automatically defeats that. When you've got presumptions, they automatically defeat no evidence summary judgment motions. So I do, yes, it can defeat the summary judgment motions, and I think it can work in the same context here. When you've got a presumption, it provides, our position is the bona fide issue that we will succeed on our undue influence claim. And I submit to you that the transaction, proving the fairness of the transaction can apply between spouses. Again, this court in the Lloyd case, which is cited in our brief, 2025 Westlaw 2087932, said that spouses have, quote, the same duties of good faith and fair dealing as required of partners and other fiduciaries. And the case that it cited, the Lloyd case cited the Bond versus Bond case, and it's not cited in our briefing, but it's 455 Southwest 2nd, 401, that actually required the husband in that case to prove the fairness of a transaction between he and his wife. I will tell you that the husband in that case was an attorney, and the court did note that, but that was not the basis for its holding of the husband having to prove the fairness of the transaction. And spouses can certainly undo it.
I've got a question about that. On the breach of the fiduciary duty, you cited that several times, but when I looked at the live pleading, I just saw a casual reference to fiduciary duty with regard to the TRO. I did not see that you pled a cause of action for breach of fiduciary duty. Can you identify where in your live pleading it occurs?
Your Honor, you're identifying the correct place in our pleading. And I would submit to you is that the breach of fiduciary duty, we've certainly alleged a lot of facts that would support a breach of fiduciary duty. And it extends, I think, in a notice pleading setting that we could then amend our pleadings to have a breach of fiduciary duty claim to support the invalidation of the documents that we're talking about. So I will. You've identified the correct place in our pleadings, but I think it can be used to support Judge Chu's temporary injunction in this case, because at the hearing, we certainly put on a lot of evidence regarding a breach of fiduciary duty.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
As you approach, I have a question right off the bat.
Of course, I mean,
you do concede that ancillary and pendency, it's expansive, right? I mean, there's companies owned by somebody that there could be breach of contract cases that get brought in. You agree with that?
As long as it affects the administration of the estate, and in this case, it does not. All that will be resolved with the trust claims is who's the beneficiary, who gets basically the proceeds from these trusts, the benefits of these trusts. In no world does the estate get any of the benefits of these trusts. There is no link between administering the estate and the trust claims. What this court has been clear several times is that is the link, that's the connection that must be made. And it just simply has not, and frankly, cannot be met on this record. With regard to that as well, because I think it dovetails off that point nicely, there still must be a showing that these are ancillary and pendent claims. The appellees talked about the Schultz claim. That falls, with regard to attorney's fees, that falls under pendent claims. Pendent claims are third-party claims. Tawny Ledbetter is a party to this litigation no matter how you frame it. These are not pendent claims. The appellees have never been able to show that the trust claims are pendent or ancillary. They just frankly are not.
Well, I mean, you use blacks to define ancillary. I mean, what's your position on that?
Yeah, so I'll just point the court to the 14th Court of Appeals precedent, which this court cited in the Shell case, as well as the Austin precedent that we cited in our briefing, which are the only Texas decisions to define pendent and ancillary. If this court were to adopt a different definition, it would be going against the only Texas cases since the 90s that have adopted this definition. This section of the probate code has been revised and fine-tuned over those decades, meaning the presumption that the legislature has blessed those decisions goes into effect. The appellees have given no reason to needlessly create a conflict in Texas law. So I think that should be the reason not to go that route. One other point I want to make about jurisdiction. I found it quite revealing that the appellee said that 25.003D, a county court at law with 25.003D jurisdiction, has original probate jurisdiction. I will refer the court to subsection A of the Hood County statute, which says, in addition to the jurisdiction provided by 25.003 and other law, the county court at law has this other jurisdiction. Now, that incorporates subsection 25.003D. If that's the magic touch that provides original probate jurisdiction, Hood County has it. Now, subsection E and subsection C narrow that jurisdiction somewhat so that original probate jurisdiction extends to contested probate matters and matters under the with relation to guardianship proceedings. But that's really the scope of the original probate jurisdiction. That original probate jurisdiction exists in the Hood County statute. And again, I'll note that the Cook County statute, it's that same exact language in subsection A of the Cook County statute and the Hood County statute. And this court in Strong, footnote 3, says that that creates original probate jurisdiction. What that means, they don't ever get to 32003 because Hood County has a county court at law exercising original probate jurisdiction. 3204 applies. Statutory probate judge cannot be appointed under 32004 of the Estates Code. The last point that I want to make relates to section 32007. Justice Walker, you asked the question about the introductory clause to 3206. I don't want to overstate my case, but basically the answer was don't look at 3206. 007 is the place to go. The problem is 3207 is not an independent grant of jurisdiction. I explained all of the reasons why, that would render 3206, 31.02 meaningless, because those grants of jurisdiction are listed elsewhere. 32007 merely provides the circumstances which already granted jurisdiction is concurrent with the business.
Wasn't there a position that you look at 008?
I'm sorry, I don't have 008 in front. It was 007 is what he referenced in his argument. I don't think there is an 008. Okay. I could be wrong about it. Nobody cited that in the briefing. So in sum, 3207 doesn't get them anywhere. It's not an independent grant of jurisdiction. You have to deal with the introductory clause to 3206, and the appellees have no answer. And that's even if they get a statutory probate judge, and I don't think they do. With that, if the court doesn't have any other questions, I will yield the rest of my time to the court.
Thank you. Gentlemen, we appreciate your argument here today. It's been very helpful to us. The case is now submitted. And you're free to go. Thank you.
All right. The Honorable Court of Appeals for the Second District of Texas now stands adjourned.